First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Disinformation is stalling climate action. Good morning, and live with you this morning from Studio 2. I'm Joe McLean with News for Jax. I'm sitting in for Melissa Ross this morning. This is First Coast Connect. Thank you so much for listening. Just ahead, we took a look at a new analysis on climate disinformation and how it's affecting public perception. We want you to join the conversation, calling 549-2937. Later on in the hour, we will hear from New York Times bestselling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic Jerry Saltz. But first this hour, a new analysis finds that false and misleading claims about climate change and clean energy made by right-wing media outlets are affecting public perception, and the fossil fuel industry is riding that wave of disinformation to promote false solutions. We may be seeing the results of that disinformation campaign play out right here in Northeast Florida. According to polling data from Yale and George Mason University, 70% of respondents who live in the Jacksonville metro area accept that climate change is happening, but only about half think it's being driven by human activity. Also, just 54% of people on the First Coast know that the vast majority of scientists agree that climate change is happening. To discuss this new analysis and a new survey results from called The Impacts of Climate Disinformation on Public Perception, we're joined this morning by Bob Berwin, a reporter from Inside Climate News, who's calling in from Egypt right now, where the COP27 conference was held. Bob, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Also joining us, Harriet Kingaby, co-founder of Conscious Advertising Network. Harriet, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start initially with Bob. I want to hear, you wrote an article describing the pace of progress at COP27. For those who aren't familiar, COP27, a conference of world leaders to discuss climate change solutions. Bob, you described in your article progress of that conference was slow. What can you explain?
Well, there's an urgent need for this United Nations climate governance process to really face up to the fact that we need to phase out fossil fuel use as fast as possible. And at the end of the conference, they had failed once again to do that.
And I want to,
in a nutshell,
right, I want to speak to what your article goes over, and it's looks at this results of a survey that was commissioned by Climate Action Against Disinformation and the Conscious Advertising Network. The survey was the report is entitled "Impacts of Climate Disinformation on Public Perception." Harriet, I want to bring you in as the co-founder of a Conscious Advertising Network. Tell us about this study and what it found.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, I think this study was all about looking at actually what public perceptions were around various different kind of climate mis and disinformation narratives. And we look at the science when we're looking at what we consider to be climate mis and disinformation, because, you know, there is 99% of scientists do agree that climate change is happening and that it's made by us. And what we found was there was just this huge gap in between what science is saying and what the public believes. You know, you pointed to the fact that actually half of people in the US actually don't think that climate change is caused by human activity. And obviously this is really difficult, because if you want to pass good climate policy, if we want to get people engaged in the solutions, then we need people to be bought in, and we need people to really understand what's really happening.
You have to have good information to make good decisions, essentially.
Exactly, yes.
And Bob, let's talk a little bit more about what's in your article. You mentioned some of what is that shows evidence as to being a major contributing factor to some of the misinformation and disinformation on climate issues. And you specifically, the article specifically mentioned several times Fox News as an outlet. Obviously, it's a major media outlet in the United States. Talk about that as an influence.
Well, the article was co-written with another reporter at Inside Climate News, and he actually wrote the sections on Fox News. So I don't feel like I can speak to that directly, other than to say that, you know, it's pretty obvious that Fox News has been the major disseminator of false climate information in the United States for a long time. And I want to add to all this that this goes back decades. This isn't anything new. Climate disinformation started in the 60s, the late 60s, when fossil fuel company scientists themselves concluded that burning fossil fuels would contribute to dangerous disruptive warming. And they launched immediately a major disinformation campaign that has persisted for decades and has been funded by millions, tens of millions of dollars to keep people in the dark about this. And you know what we're talking about in this latest survey shows that effort that they started way back then is still going on, and that they've succeeded in confusing a lot of people about scientific reality.
That other reporter he mentioned, Christopher Teague, and we want you to join the conversation as well. We're already getting some calls. 549-2937. And I want to read the section that he referenced, just a quick little portion. So this survey surveyed 2,396 American participants. And of those, the survey found that false climate beliefs were even more prevalent among those who regularly watch Fox News, who identified themselves as Fox News viewers. 59% of Fox News consumers believe a significant number of scientists disagree on the cause of climate change, compared to just 35% of the broader U.S. sample. Again, we heard from Harriet that 99% of scientists agree that climate change is happening. So a troubling disparity there. Let's bring in some of your calls. Todd from the South Side, you're on the air. Go ahead, Todd.
Good morning. I've been following COP27. I think it ends this tomorrow. And what is absolutely correct that one of your guests was saying, the fossil fuel industry has been fueling this disinformation and information campaign since the very beginning. They are threatened, and anything that threatens the fossil fuel industry, they're going to try to control it. And I give you an example. This COP27 was basically taken over by corporations. The people who were suffering from it weren't even allowed to protest outside. And so what we're seeing here is basically capitalist corporations, controlling and making sure that we don't move ahead regarding fighting climate change. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Todd, thank you very much. Harriet, I'd like you to speak to that. What are the influences here, the interests at play?
Well, yes. I mean, there were only over 600 oil and gas lobbyists at this year's COP, which is a massive increase on last year. So yes, you know, we've got a space where we are trying to create a global plan and get global agreement around, kind of what needs to happen for all of us to, for all of our, futures around climate change. And we've got people there who have, extreme ties to the industry that's behind a lot of this. But there are huge, I think the oil and gas lobby is behind a lot of this mis and disinformation. We did see when we were looking, we monitor the online conversations over the COP process, and we see increasing amounts of mis and disinformation just around oil and gas in general. We also see kind of culture wars framings, which attempt to kind of pit different parts of society against each other. It's very, very difficult as an ordinary citizen, I think, to make up your mind and to find the right information that's out there. I would just urge anyone who is thinking, well, gosh, is this really happening? Where do I go for credible sources of information to say, well, look, you know, quality reporting is really, really important. You can also look to places like NASA, who does really, really good communications around climate change. But absolutely, you know, when we do have these influences present, we do have to really, really, really think about the information we're consuming, and also just be just be aware that there are lots of people out there who are trying to influence us and who might not have our best interests at heart.
Part of the responsibility is us as news consumers, as well as media organizations.
Can I add something briefly?
Absolutely, Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure that anybody who's directly involved in the negotiations at these climate conferences is somehow directly influenced by disinformation. I interviewed 30, 40 people directly involved in the negotiations and other folks who were there observing the conference, and none of them have any doubt that climate change is caused by humans, that it's serious, and that we can fix it if we stop burning fossil fuels. It's more that this disinformation affects national governments. It affects the ability to have national governments that are willing to act. And the COP process, the UN process, can only do what national governments bring to the table. There's no COP king who can, say we need to do this and that, and you have to do that. It's a question of positions that countries bring to the conference. And in some cases, those are already pre-shaped by this disinformation campaign from people who vote for politicians who represent that line, that false information.
And obviously the results of these surveys indicate that disinformation has an effect on the populace, on the electorates of these governments. You're right. Listening to WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. If you're just joining us, we're discussing climate misinformation and disinformation and its effect on policy. We're joined by Bob Berwin of Inside Climate News and Harriet Kingaby, the co-founder of Conscious Advertising Network. I want to look at some local numbers here in our area of Northeast Florida. Some research showed there is some consensus on some things. The majority of voters, I want to speak to some of the statistics, some of the survey results that showed the most consensus among the survey respondents. 77% of survey respondents, again, this is from specifically Duval County, Florida. 77% agreed that it's a good idea to fund research into renewable energy sources. 77%. Also, 77% said that agreed that providing tax rebates for energy efficient vehicles or solar panels. So very popular there. More than three-fourths of respondents agreed with that. And then 79%, almost 4 out of 5 respondents, said schools should teach about global warming. Harriet, your reaction to those numbers, there is some consensus here.
Well, I think that's absolutely fantastic. And I think that we should, as well as funding research into renewable energy, we need to be kind of getting this stuff up as quickly as possible, because it is kind of clean and cheap way of actually, kind of quite quickly taking action on climate. So it's fantastic to hear that your listeners feel like this. And I think, when we're looking at things like the prevalence of mis and disinformation, and when we hear things like 600 oil and gas lobbyists at the COP negotiations, I think it can be tempting to think we're not going to fix this, or to lose hope. I think we have to be practical here. There's some brilliant solutions that already exist, and if we we just need to implement them quickly, and benefit from the increase in kind of jobs and skills and everything like that they bring with them. So great to hear.
Bill from Maxville, you're joining the call. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. To wean ourselves off the energy dollar, the petrodollar, is going to take a long time. There are other things that we can implement immediately to help with climate change, and that would be to stop monocropping, to grow several different crops to capture more carbon. And it's simple. There's nothing controversial about that. There's no argument. There's no conspiracy theories. You simply stop monocropping all over the world as quickly as possible. Grow several different crops to capture more of the carbon in the atmosphere, and that would help remediate some of the issues we have. That's all.
Bill, thank you very much. Bob, let's talk about some of the solutions. Not exactly short-term solutions. Does that make policymaking harder in that, you know, the public won't see immediate impacts, or, you know, it's sort of intangible when you make a positive climate policy? It's not always immediately tangible, if you will.
Mm-hmm. There is a lot of opposition from agribusinesses to fundamental changes to the way we do agriculture. So to say that it's not controversial is, you know, it may not be controversial to some people, but the agriculture, the industrial agriculture industry is closely tied to the fossil fuel industry through the use of fertilizers. And, you know, it's hard to get changes like that through. Secondly, there are a lot of things we all have to do at the same time right now in the next 10, 20, 30 years to try and avoid the global temperature from heating to a super dangerous level. The goal is, you know, hopefully 1.5 degrees. We're at 1.2 degrees Celsius right now above the pre-industrial average. So we have to change our agricultural and land use practices. We have to change our energy systems. We have to change the way we build buildings. And the technology for all this stuff really actually already exists. It's not a question of finding new technologies. As your caller mentioned, there are some huge changes that could be made in agriculture fairly quickly to really reduce carbon dioxide emissions. And it is a political and cultural fight. The science is completely clear. There's plenty of research on renewable energy, on land use practices, on forestry, on transportation. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do more research, because we'll always learn more and we'll find better solutions. But the solutions are already there, and they're outlined in major science reports like those from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which you know, is this global body of thousands of scientists who look at all the studies in a 5 or 6 year cycle. And in the last one that came out just ahead of COP, they talk about really needing sort of fundamental transformation in these big sectors that cause the most greenhouse gas emissions.
Harriet, in your experience, I remember, even when I was a kid, I remember this conversation, even about the existence of climate change, of man-made climate change, was the big debate. It feels, though, from these numbers that may have shifted to where there's just more and more consensus. Is that what you have seen as well?
Well, we have seen some interesting things, and I wish I was as optimistic as you. What we have seen, and I think what these numbers show, is that there are a lot of people that really don't understand what's happening. There's climate literacy is quite low. We know that people don't necessarily think that climate change is being caused by us. That seems to be a barrier and an information point that we need to quickly talk to people about and hopefully solve. What we have seen is that people, those who are very interested in us not taking any action on climate, have shifted the way they talk about climate change. So before, they were talking about, well, climate change is a hoax, it's not happening, or it's not us. A lot of these organizations and people have shifted into what we call delay narratives. And what they do is they very cleverly say, look, you know, we agree that climate change is a problem, but we can't fix it right now. Or we have to wait until some other country does something before we can fix it. Or in fact, it's going to be too expensive, so why don't we do it, you know, in 10 years' time? And what these narratives do is they sound really reasonable. They play on people's fears. We are living in a time of kind of extreme costs are rising, and there is unrest across the globe. And you know, it, I think these narratives are very, very clever, and they do make people think, well, actually, maybe we need to prioritize something else first, or we need to fix this further down the line. And obviously, the longer we wait to fix these kind of problems, the more expensive it's going to be, the more upheaval it's going to cause. So it's very, very important that we call out these narratives and recognize them for what they are, which is actually really counter to what we need to see and how quickly we need to move.
I think what I was observing was the shift away from that narrative being a denial narrative, and now shifting towards what you observed as being a deflection narrative. I want to bring in Stanley from downtown. Stanley, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes. I run a national think tank, African-American think tank, and one of the major issues that I see in this country is the leadership problem. We talk about everything, and we can talk about our individual problems, but the number one problem, you have a leadership problem in America. Before 1980, America was in the top three when it came to education. America's over 20th in education. It's a lot. The number one issue when it comes to this.
Stanley, we're kind of losing your call, but he brings up a good point about education. Bob, we got a couple minutes left here. What is should be the thinking when we're educating, when we're communicating? And Harriet, I also want you to speak to this as well, about the role of media organizations. What should be the priority? What should be the thinking when we're communicating about this? Bob, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I'll say that the final report, or rather the final cover letter from this conference, the COP27, in Egypt, included the topic of education as a, you know, as an, its own separate line. And I actually think it starts before the media in schools. And I've been seeing encouragingly more and more news from different countries about how climate and environmental literacy are both starting to get a focus. Not expecting to see that in widespread across the US, but we're seeing it in other countries, so that when people come out of school, they, you know, they have some idea of all this and can then decide for themselves, and will be pretty, you know, pretty much able to tell the difference between correct information and incorrect information. In terms of the media, just briefly, and then I'll let Harriet talk to that a little more. I think the media should focus on solutions, as you talked about, and sort of convey the message, hey, we know what the problem is, it's settled. We know we already have the solutions in place. And let's get going on this, because we really do not have a lot of time. We really don't.
Harriet, this Yale and George Mason University survey found that 2/3 of respondents said they hear about global warming in the media at least once a week. Two-thirds said they hear about it once a month or less often. So we're not talking about this in the media very much, is the perception of the audience. How do we change that?
I agree. And I think, you know, one of the things that we found previously is that actually there are not that many, actually advertisers are inadvertently not funding a lot of really great climate reporting, because advertisers fund a lot of our media environment. You know, you turn on your telly and you see adverts, and that's what funds it. You pick up your newspaper and there they are. And we are working to encourage advertisers to actively fund organizations like, you know, media outlets that are producing really great climate content, because we feel like we need to hear more about it, and we need that information to be credible. So, you know, we as individuals, as well as as well as policymakers and those who have that kind of power, so that we hear really quality information about it. We really understand how it's going to affect us, and also what are the opportunities that certain things can, you know, climate action can bring to my area and to me and my family. So, what we want to see is a media environment where it where organisations can feel confident that if they do produce this stuff, that it's not going to, it's not going to fall on deaf ears. So,
Harriet,
yes.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yes, Harriet Kingaby, thank you. Thank you very much. Co-founder of Conscious Advertising Network, also Inside Climate News reporter Bob Berwin, calling in from Egypt. Thank you both so much for being with us this morning.
You're welcome.
Much more still ahead. Later, a little good news for your Wednesday, but up next.
So what this book is, it's an accidental history of the art of the 21st century.
A conversation with author and art critic Jerry Saltz on his new book, Art is Life. We'll be right back. Welcome back. He's a former truck driver and a self-described failed artist. Jerry Saltz went on to become a Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic and New York Times best-selling author. An early champion of forgotten and overlooked women artists, Saltz has celebrated the pioneering work of African-American, Indigenous, LGBTQ+, and other long-marginalized creators. He has also become beloved online, amassing more than a million dedicated followers on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Throughout the early years of the 21st century, Saltz has been reported on a period. He's reported on a period from the cultural reset of 9/11 to the rolling social crises of today that he considers among the most important, dynamic, and world-changing in all of art history. Now he brings together more than 20 years of work in a powerful new volume that traces how the visionary artists of these years have both documented and challenged the culture. Melissa Ross spoke with him about his new book, Art is Life, Icons and Iconoclasts, Visionaries and Vigilantes, and Flashes of Hope in the Night. Let's take a listen.
Jerry Saltz, it's good to be with you, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa. Hope everything is great down there in Florida.
We are hanging in there, you know, and I think your book, Art is Life, is a perfect holiday gift for anyone who values the role of artists to move the culture, to spark conversations. Tell us a little bit about what inspired this book.
Well, for listeners that don't know, I'm the senior art critic for New York Magazine. I have no degrees. I started as an artist in my 20s, and the same demons that you all listened to last night at 3:15 in the morning that said you're no good, you don't know what you're doing, you've got bad ankles, you're a bad schmoozer. Well, I listened to those demons, Melissa, unlike you and other people. I self-exiled from being an artist, which I had loved being. I became a long-distance truck driver, believe it or not. I think the only Jewish one at the time.
Oh, wow.
And I drove from New York to Florida, New York to Texas once a month in these big trucks. I was delivering art, again, because I'm a Jew. I don't think I'm allowed to haul steel. In any event, when I was about in my late 30s, Melissa, I decided that I was so miserable and I loved art from afar so much that anything would be better than being a truck driver. So slowly, in the trucks, I taught myself to become an art critic. Now, has anybody ever tried to write, you'll know that writing is the worst thing on earth you can do. It's just the worst. Deadlines, however, are sent from heaven to us via hell. And so I scared up some jobs, started teaching myself to write, danced naked, and learned on the job in public, danced naked in public, that is, so to speak, metaphorically, and started to write. For me, art is incredible. It's the most advanced operating system our species has ever developed to explore consciousness, the seen, and the unseen world. That every picture tells a story, not only of its maker, but of the time, the place, the context, the biography, and it's all embedded in the material. So what this book is, long story short, is it's an accidental history of the art of the 21st century as seen by an art critic, loser art critic, who accidentally lashed himself to the ship of art over these last 22 years and wrote weekly and sometimes daily reports from the storm. And in this period came the greatest changes in art history that have ever taken place in art. And the book is a sort of, war report, if you will, from the front lines of the good, the bad, the very bad, the high, the low, the winners, the losers, the hangers-ons, the ones that burned out and didn't make it, and all of us in between.
Well, then, Jerry, what would be an example of how the art of this time period, the first two decades of the 21st century, has been so impactful?
A couple of ways. Let's look at the positive side first. That every work of art made in the 21st century, Melissa, from the contested 2000 election there in Florida, through the Iraq and Afghanistan Bush-Cheney wars, to the sense that the arc of art of history was bending towards justice, possibly under the first black president, to a kind of the return of the long American night in 2016, through the contested election of 2020 to yesterday, nothing has been made under vaguely normal conditions. And one of the things that happened during this, for good and bad, is the walls of art history came tumbling down. We saw the end of the ideology of modernism. Nobody any longer believed that art was linear. We suddenly understood it told a great story, but the story of how it was told isn't true. And more women artists, more underrepresented artists, artists of color, disabled. I'm an illegal Estonian immigrant myself. Estonians showed. And the point being that finally, for the first time in the history of art, Melissa, we were seeing far more than 50% of the story than had never been seen before. On the other side of the fence, more money than has ever rushed into the art world set upon us. And now we read about, like, obscene prices, mad auctions, the invention. If you saw a movie called The Last Leonardo, they recorded me. I happened to be the only art critic that looked at that Leonardo da Vinci, the Salvator Mundi. And again, I have no art degrees, Melissa. I went to Christie's and wrote this, that the painting isn't a Leonardo. It's quite handsome, I suppose, but it's certainly dead, and track the provenance of it. Of course, it was like a dreamed-up magic carpet ride by paying the most amount of money for the biggest name in art history to try to enter art history that way, and now this idiot art critic turns out to have been right, that it was bought for $400+ million. And like I said beforehand, it'll be fun to hang somewhere if they can ever hang it with that name on it. And they can't. That's why it's never been seen in public. But that was the period that we were in and we still are in. Long story short, in one of the most earnest, sincere moments in all of art, where all of these new people are making art and showing their own story, you have the cynical side of the equation that too many people see through, that we see it all, this money and elite and prices and just this thing that feels grotesque. So the book tries to take you through and make you understand that only 1% of 1% of 1% of all artists make any money. It's just that the press you're seeing, 99% of the press, is on that 1%.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's a fantastic story of accomplishment and vision by the artist.
But, you know, as you pointed out, you just love art, and people that are driven to make art typically aren't doing it for the money. They're just compelled to create beautiful works of art. And as your book shows, art lifts us all up. Art is vital to humanity.
Amen. I think it's part of a cosmic force, is what you're indicating without saying it, that's never not been with us. It may have no use, but we've never been able to get along without it. It may be using us to reproduce itself. Bob Dylan even talked about how it's like a ghost is writing the song and has picked him to write it. You know this on your show. I know it in my work, where I never know what I'm going to write until I write it. And I'm always somewhat surprised by what I wrote. Mm-hmm. Like, where did this come from? People listening to this, if you will get out of your own way and get out of the easy harbor of your fear loop that goes, I'm no good, I have bad ankles, I don't know what I'm doing, I'm a fake. That's the easiest thing to say. We all say that at 3:15 in the morning. What I'm asking you to do is take what's uncertain, unfamiliar, and challenging, and that's how you map new things in your bad writing, your bad art, your bad radio, your bad movies, your bad literature. Take it from me, a bad writer. If you build it that way, they might come. Just get out of your own way. And if I may offer one piece of advice to the listeners, work, 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 you big babies. Just get to work. God.
Well, I love your advice. And, you know, I have the same 3:15 tremors in the middle of the night. I think we all do. But this is such a bracing and life-affirming message that is in your book, and I really recommend it. It's Art is Life by Pulitzer Prize winning art critic and New York Times bestselling author Jerry Saltz, a perfect gift for the art lover in your life. Jerry, it's so much fun to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa, and best to everyone in Florida. We're all thinking of you. We love you no matter what you do.
Welcome back. I'm Joe McLean. I'm sitting in for Melissa Ross this morning. The number to call, 549-2937. Well, one of Jacksonville's more prominent healthy restaurants is closing its doors after 5 years. Owner Wen Rady has announced that Haka Kitchen, formerly known as the House of Leaf and Bean, will be closing on December 18th. Wen joins us in the studio to tell us why she's decided to bring to an end what has become her life's passion. Wen, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Take us back to the beginning when you decided to start this business. What was the mission statement?
Yes. When I look back right now, just feel like just like yesterday. So you say, what brought me to this mission? It's part of my health journey. Actually, it's in 2016, and when I was in Leadership Jacks, throughout the classes, a couple of things hit me. One is poverty, the other one is the sustainability. Of course, not only the health, but also the environment. So that hit me. I say, I can do something. I know something. Because of my own health, I started different path of living in a different lifestyle. For example, eating cleaner food, more plant-based, and a regular exercise, and I started meditation. So all of this, I know something. I wanted to show our community your alternative lifestyle rather than every day we just work and a very stressful life, and also meet. So I didn't know what I should do to start a mission. I am Chinese-American. I grew up in China, and also ate a lot of bean products tofu, I often call it, is the king of the beans, have a really rich protein, and also as perfect as the protein from meat. So I said, well, maybe I should introduce tofu into our community. Plus, in our country, we grow a lot of soybeans. I said, instead of we're trying to beg people to buy our soybeans, why don't we start it? You know, eating ourselves and feed our body. And it's just the best protein, better than meat sometimes, right? So that's how I started. I said, okay, maybe I should start making fresh tofu. And I said, well, when I make fresh tofu, nobody will buy from me. I said, maybe I should have a restaurant. And then, you know, I make all different type of dishes. So people might think that, oh, the tofu is not bad. That's how I started the restaurant concept.
And obviously, Hakka Kitchen was... it was pretty popular, but like so many other businesses, it was obviously experienced significant challenges during the pandemic and all of the net effects from that. Mm-hmm. Talk about the lead up to this tough decision that you made.
Yes. Yeah, when I look back, I just feel like I want just so much tears. Yes, actually during COVID, we were so fortunate. We still have a lot of regulars coming through drive-through, pretty much just every week. They just come to pick up some things. But you know, we have to open, close for whatever the reasons. Sometimes it could be a couple staff got the COVID and then we had to close because we could not find enough people to continue open. So all this keep going on. And in the end, we said we need to do something else because only have a drive-through open up is not enough. And we have a few ideas that's relaunching as a Hakka Kitchen. We said we wanted to have a sit-down food service so that we can spend time with our customers about our food, about the healthy eating. That's how, from COVID-19 and then switch to Hakka Kitchen. So we wanted to focus on more of Chinese cuisine, more uniquely related to my personal background.
And of course, the staffing became a big challenge, such that you were sort of doing a lot of the jobs yourself. Mm-hmm. Talk about when you finally made the decision, it was partly because of burnout.
Mm-hmm. Correct, exactly. This is constantly looking for new employees. When we train someone, and then they leave for better jobs or other better options. So we just constantly not enough staff. When one person is sick for whatever reason or whatever the personal reason, and then we end up nobody in the kitchen or in the front. So I have to juggle many roles at one time.
And really quick, before we go, I want to hear, you have some plans for the future. Obviously, the restaurant will be open until December 18th, and then you'll be doing something online. Quickly explain that.
Yes. So I will, I wanted to keep our online tea shop opened. We still will have some frozen or organic vegan items. So if anyone in our community wanted to continue purchase certain items, and they can still shop our online tea shop. Right now, we call it tea shop.
Okay, gotcha. Owner Wen Rady announcing the closure of Hakka Kitchen, a very disappointing announcement for many of our listeners, I'm sure, closing December 18th. Wen, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Immerse yourself in the tranquil soundscapes of Debussy, Tchaikovsky, and Sibelius with the Jacksonville Symphony and returning guest conductor Nathan Aspinall. From the ethereal opening flute solo in Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun to Tchaikovsky's famous violin concerto performed by acclaimed violinist Timothy Chui, these concerts will illuminate Jacoby Symphony Hall for two nights only on December 2nd and 3rd. Tickets at jacksymphony.org.
It's the 1990s in Moscow, and you're trying to launch the Russian version of Sesame Street.
I thought at least the easy part of doing this production would be they would love the Muppets. Everybody loves the Muppets. Wow, no.
Showrunner Natasha Lance Rogoff reflects on culture clashes and how children's programming can still point a way forward in times of crisis. It's On the World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Deepa Fernandez. Latin jazz bandleader Eddie Palmieri made a name for himself during New York's mambo heydays.
The Palladium Ballroom was packed. They were all great dancers, and the orchestras that didn't excite the dancer, they never brought him back.
Eddie Palmieri on life, music, and still being a student in his 80s. Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
No other single sporting event draws an audience as big as the World Cup. Host Qatar has promised to make this year's event a, quote, milestone for the Middle East. And for all the drama off the pitch, plenty of news will be made on it. Next time on 1A, can this month-long soccer fest rise above the scandals and live up to its billing as the beautiful game?
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Starting this weekend, Dazzling Nights at Jacksonville Arboretum and Botanical Gardens will transform into a stunning winter wonderland featuring a million dazzling lights, shining forests, magical displays, music, and beautiful sculptures. Melissa Ross got a preview from Dana Duty, executive director of the Arboretum. Take a listen.
Hey, Dana. Good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, the way you transform the Jack's Arboretum at the holidays is so fantastic. I think a lot of people are looking forward to this. Tell us about this year's Dazzling Nights.
Well, we're really excited about it. It's actually a redesigned show. It's going to have some favorites from last year, but they're really transforming it into a different experience this year. There were a few COVID restrictions still happening last year, so it was like a timed adventure. This year it's going to be a choose your own adventure, so you can go and take your time through all of the different exhibits and experience all the beautiful lights. There's going to be some gorgeous Moroccan lights on display with our beautiful oak trees, and you get to walk through stars. Like, it's just truly beautiful. We're just so excited about it. And Memoir Agency does this thing where they are fantastic with different characters, and this year they've promised some character interactions, so I don't even know what that truly entails yet. But they really do excellent characters, so I can't wait to see what they have in store for us.
This is all a great way for people who've never been to the Arboretum and Gardens to come check it out too, right?
Oh, absolutely. And this year, we've paved the path that goes entirely around the lake loop. So it's even more wheelchair-friendly and stroller-friendly this year. So everyone with all abilities will be able to experience it.
Okay. Now, the Arboretum I always think of as just this incredible gem right in the heart of the city. It's sort of a tucked away place of absolute natural beauty. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of the Arboretum?
Sure. So it's a really interesting place in Jacksonville because it was once a mine. So they used to mine for materials for the war, like titanium. And so it has all these interesting textures to it because it was dug out in places. So it has deep ravines, and it has these beautiful areas. Like, the lake is actually a man-made lake, but they dug it so deep that it's spring-fed, so it's clean and beautiful all year round, and the trails are absolutely beautiful. And when they did create the mine, when it grew back into a natural state, the mine actually made it even more interesting because it gave us 13 different ecosystems. So there's so much to experience, learn from, and also be able to meditate, get mental wellness out there. It's just a really beautiful place to be and soak in just some of the most beautiful oak trees, 200-year-old oak trees, because during the mining process, they actually saved the oak trees so that the miners could sit and enjoy lunch under the shade. So it really does have a really rich and unique history.
It really does. And in the middle of a pretty urban part of town, too, it makes it all the more remarkable.
I mean, it's an urban forest. It's right in the center of everything. I mean, you can get to it from anywhere in Jacksonville within 15 minutes. It's really an ideal location.
That's so true. Now, with all of that said, how can people get their tickets for Dazzling Nights at the Jacksonville Arboretum?
Well, they just have to go to dazzlingjacks.com, and you can select which evening that you'd like to come. Tickets are $25 each, $22 for children, and 3 and under are free.
And all to raise money to keep the Arboretum beautiful all year round. So it's a great cause, too.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah. Yes, it is. It's the most important part.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it keeps this gem looking beautiful. So get your tickets at dazzlingjacks.com for Dazzling Nights at the Jacksonville Arboretum and Botanical Gardens opening Black Friday, correct?
That's correct.
All right, folks. Dana Duty, thank you. She's executive director of the Jacks Arboretum and Gardens. Have fun with it.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And a little more good news for your Wednesday. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving. It's already good news. The following day is Black Friday, as we all know. The following day after that is always Small Business Saturday. Downtown Jacksonville's doing a special event there. It's a online, it's a mobile scavenger hunt. For more information there, you can possibly win some gift cards. dtjacks.com/shopsmall. That's hashtag shop small. So Small Business Saturday supports small businesses. Finally, this hour, the third and final concert in the Jazz on the River series is going to feature 904 star Ulysses Owens Jr. and Friends. That's Sunday, November 27th from 4:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Riverfront Park. That's 100 Memorial Parkway in Palatka. That's free. It's a family-friendly event. Ulysses Owens Jr. is performer, producer, educator. We're going to listen to some of his music, which was voted Rising Star Big Band of 2022 by Downbeat Magazine. Let's take a listen to some of Ulysses and the crew right now. Our executive producer, David Luckin. Our senior producer, Heather Schatz. Our producer is Brendan Rivers. Our director is Isabella Da Silva. With technical help from Morning Edition host Michelle Corum. If you have questions, comments, you can email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Joe McLean, sitting in for Melissa Ross this morning. Thank you so much for putting up with me. She'll be back before you know it, though. First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you so much. Make today a positive day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.